am David
Corn. And I'm Jim Pinkerton.
And welcome to
Blogging Heads TV. Round 57 or whatever we're up to by now.
Where our motto is, we don't care what we wear as pants. And neither should you. Well, so let me take this dispatch sent to us from Hion, from Bob Wright, with our talking points for the day. And let's go right to topic one, Jim.
Okay.
You know, call me naive. Go ahead, call me naive. Go ahead.
Okay. I'll knock. Okay.
But, you know, yesterday on the front page of the Washington Post, there was a story that I think you and I both noticed that said, in essence, political reconciliation in Iraq is unachievable, impossible. Who says that? The Iraqi government officials were supposed to achieve it. You know, it was the front page of the Post. It was a one-column front page story. And, you know, I keep waiting for reality in Iraq to have some impact on politics and policymaking in Washington, and I just don't see it happening. Wasn't the whole premise of the surge, of the escalation of troops, that we were creating a breathing space to allow Iraqi officials to engage in political reconciliation? If they themselves say it's impossible and can't be done, what's the point?
Well, of course, the first sales job that you and I are going to have to do, David, since we happen to agree on this issue, at least among the whole panoply of issues, is sell the Washington Post editorial page on this position. I mean,
maybe they don't read the rest of the paper. They're too busy writing those editorials going, go Dick Cheney, go.
I think that about sums it up. I think that is sort of, I actually was just reminded that I'd written a piece for, of all places, Salon.com back in August of 2004 about how the Washington Post editorial page under Fred Hyatt is a neocon citadel. And it still is. And so one wonders, I mean, in other words, that's the dilemma we have, is that so much of the power structure in this town is still committed to the neocon policies. And my friend Kelly Bokar Vlahos, writing in the American Conservative magazine, has a piece about all the foreign policy advisors to the presidential candidates and how most of them are, surprise, surprise, still kind of, you know, out of the neocon playbook, including on the Democratic side, you know.
Okay, but well, I don't want to engage in your easy media bashing here, but not that I disagree with anything you said about the Washington Post, but at some point, doesn't what happens in the real world matter? I mean, sure, the neocons at the Washington Post can keep writing editorials and keep moving the goalpost and come up with new rationales. But, I mean, the Republicans in Congress, I mean, they've tied themselves to the mast of the SS Bush, and they seem to be willing to go down with the ship. Are Americans, you know, the polls show that they're not in favor of the war, but they don't seem to be all that angry about it either.
Well, I think that's, let's face it, the Democrats, I mean, you know, they asked the Democrats in their debates, who's going to commit to getting the troops out by the end of your first term? And I'm trying to remember who said, yes, he or she would get out by the end of the first term, but it was, you know...
It was Kucinich and... Richardson,
right, exactly. And so the top three Democrats, the ones who are between them, are almost certain to get the nomination. That'd be Hillary, Edwards, and Obama. All basically said, or at least wouldn't say they wouldn't, keep the troops...
Well, I differ with you on this, because I thought Tim Russert was being a little immature in that question, not as a person, in that, you know, to say, you know, none of these guys would take office for a year and a half. For them to commit to getting every single combat troop out, or any troop, I don't think he even used the phrase combat troop, but to get every single troop out, as opposed to troops who might be guarding the border, might be guarding the... trillion-dollar embassy compound that we're building, which for what, I don't know, they haven't done too good a job now.
Don't forget fighting terrorism.
Yeah, fighting terrorism. Troops are chasing al-Qaeda in Iraq, if there's still an al-Qaeda in Iraq to chase in a few years. I thought that, you know, nobody should say, I will have everybody out by date certain. They all say, we want to bring troops out. Obama, to his credit, has given a schedule, 1 to 2 brigades a month. John Edwards has said he'll take out 40 to 50,000 troops within the first 2-3 months of if we are where we are now. So I think pressing for an absolute answer was not responsible. I didn't think their answer was bad, but nevertheless, I mean, I take your large point here in that the Democrats, at least the ones in Congress, seem flummoxed about what to do regarding the Iraq war
right.
and the policy.
And I think a couple points.
But I don't
want
to blame them more than anyone else because it's the most of them didn't vote for it, though a lot did. And it's, you know, and it is Bush's war, but nevertheless, they can't figure out how to turn this thing around despite what appears on the front page of the Washington Post.
Right. They are afraid of getting tagged as losing or being responsible for the loss. And that debate here in America between the hawks and the doves, and with the hawks clearly winning here in America so far, has, I think we can agree on this much as well, has almost nothing to do with what's actually happening on the ground in Iraq. It's entirely, do you think that Rush Limbaugh is right or wrong about the phony soldiers? Do you think that, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Harry Reid, whoever is a stab in the backer. Those are huge issues in American politics, and almost nobody, certainly on the pro-war side, is saying, well, let's go study what's actually happening in Iraq, what's actually happening on the ground in terms of conciliation or lack thereof. I thought that Washington Post article that you alluded to was pretty strong on that score, but that just isn't the issue. It's sort of the essence of kind of an imperial politics, where what really matters is the micro politics of the imperial court, as opposed to what's going on off in the provinces somewhere.
Yes, and I have this, as I said earlier, naive belief that we should hold our policymakers, including the president, responsible for what they say, and the rationale for the war, for the recent escalation, really seems to have slipped away. And now it's not even been replaced with another rationale other than we can't lose.
Right.
But that's not a rationale for doing anything. It's sort of the rationale for continuing to bet at Las Vegas when you're in the hole, that you can't walk away from the table. And I believe walking away from the table could be ugly, bloody, brutal, but staying at the table isn't doing much good either.
I agree, but the only thing to bear in mind is that since the comparisons of Vietnam leap to both of our minds in terms of just memories of it all and so on, is that in terms
of... Well, I've read about Vietnam in books.
In terms of casualties, we're still about where we were in 1965 or maybe early 1966, less than 4,000.
There's no draft, of course, now. So it's people aren't being hauled off.
Exactly,
there.
Right.
There's no war tax. Although David Obeik, head of the Appropriations Committee for the Democrats in the House, said, you know what? I'd like there to be a war tax. I'll answer your question. I know what you're going to say. He wanted to say, listen, we're going to have a war. We may as well tax people and pay for it. Who came out against that?
Hillary Clinton.
And, well, more importantly, Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, his Democratic, comrades. They don't want to do this.
Right. So in other words, the infernal genius of the people who support the war is they've made it small enough that they have no real prospect of winning, that's for sure, but they also made it small enough that it doesn't become the kind of painful, psychic or fiscal wound that has to get addressed. Let's face it, David. I mean, we could be doing Blogging Heads TV 5 years from now, and it's almost it kills me to say this, but we could be talking about, we could have almost the same discussion.
Now that's depressing. Not because we'll be doing Blogging Heads TV 5 years from now, but hey, we've been having the same conversation now for about 4 years.
Four and a half.
So. Now my little obsession in the Iraq category has been the plight of Judge Radi Hamza al-Radi, the former anti-corruption chief of Iraq, who was forced out because he was doing just too good a job. He got to testify in Congress last week before Henry Waxman's House Government Operations and Reform Committee, whatever it's called, and made the same case that the government is just too corrupt to do anything, let alone achieve reconciliation. And the Republicans on the committee, several of them just came out with the most ridiculous attacks on him, and then they kind of walked away, even when the attacks didn't stick, as if they didn't care. It was really kind of a bizarre hearing. But what was worse was that Ambassador Larry Butler, who is, I never heard of him, but he's the deputy secretary for Near Eastern Affairs in the State Department, basically in charge of the Middle East, came on and said, you know what, the State Department is working long and hard on corruption issues in Iraq, and everything is just hunky-dory. And I'm thinking, you know, come on. You know, this, you know, where, when does the denial stop? And the one thing that he said that was not really on point, but which really got me thinking, was he in praising the efforts of the State Department employees who are there in Iraq, working hard under terrible conditions, he said the embassy has 100% annual turnover. 100%. That means no one stays longer than a year. There is absolutely no institutional memory. And we're building, as I said earlier on the show, an embassy that now has all these cost overruns and is going to near $1 trillion. So we're going to spend $1 trillion on an embassy compound.
Not a trillion, a billion, I think.
No, well, wasn't it?
You don't mean a trillion. A trillion is a big number.
Well, I guess not. I think three-quarters of $1 billion.
Right.
It's 142 cost overrun. That's right. Three-quarters of $1 billion, and it's going to have absolutely no human capital. It's going to be a hollow shell.
You know, it's funny. I was reading an article about the economists at the World Bank have done a study of third world countries and which ones are rich and which ones are poor. And the point they make is that the rich third world countries, at least the developing third world countries, you know, South Korea, for example, so sort of the ex-third world countries, have enormous social capital. They have enormous, you know, educational reserves and so on. Yeah. And then World Bank has figured out a way has to sort of monetize that and figure out, you know, that for example, the average American has access to $342,000 worth of intangible capital. The average Mexican has access to
Can I get a loan against that?
$42,000. And yet, yeah, in some places in the third world, this intangible capital measure is actually negative. You know, in other words, you go there and you actually, between corruption and thievery and whatever else, you're actually likely to lose money just by being there. And obviously, that's a poor formula for economic growth. And I think you could apply the same metric to U.S. foreign policy making in places where nobody speaks the language, nobody dares go outside. You know, you read these memos, you know, Al Kamen in the Washington Post is always, you know, getting...
I tell you, Jim, I've gotten to know some embassy officials in the course of doing these recent stories on Iraq corruption. And in the utter disdain that they talk about the State Department, the embassy, even themselves in a self-deprecating way, in the ability to get anything done there, is mind-boggling. You, as a taxpayer, as a citizen, it is so demoralizing to hear people who, you know, take out of their own lives, precious lives, you know, a year or two to go to Iraq and from their perspective, and even, I think objectively speaking, try to do some good for the people of Iraq, and they come back totally disenchanted with the U.S. government's ability to do anything, with the Iraqi government's ability to do anything, and just believing it's an utter waste of time. And I get the sense that, you know, between Ambassador Crocker's appearance with General David Petraeus on the Hill, between the neocons' editorials, and the fact that there are only about, I think, 30 or so real American correspondents in Baghdad, this story just isn't fully registering.
I know. The only story that's sort of broken through the static, and you, David, deserve enormous credit for helping the promote the issues raised by Judge Varaghi. Not that anybody in the U.S. government seems to care, other than Chairman Waxman and a few others. And not that anybody seems to care about the cost overruns in Iraq. The only story that sort of has some salience is the Blackwater story, which is somewhat connected in terms of the change in the way the U.S. handles foreign policy such that, for reasons I can't quite fathom, although it has something to do with sort of the privatization mania, the people who sort of do mean business and did, as it were, come to play in Iraq are private contractors who, of course, are machine-gunning civilians as they ride along in the streets, which is not so good. I mean, they're also a negative aspect, but they are real and forceful. And, you know, Eric Prince, the head of Blackwater, said, you know, in his own defense, I guess in the hearings last week, look, none of our civilian charges have been killed. And we've killed lots of Iraqi civilians. We've suffered our own casualties, but nobody we've been protecting got killed.
We protected the Americans.
And that at least, that speaks, in other words, that if that's the only thing that we, that's the only kind of efficacy that we can measure, well, then it's, our chances of actually gaining hearts and minds are pretty small.
I can just imagine how that plays in the Iraqi media. Just imagine. I mean, I don't read Arabic. I wish I did. But you know I'm sure that statement got picked up, and it's not just the Iraqi media. I'm sure it gets picked up throughout the Arab world, in terms of a friend of Dick Cheney, funder of Republican presidential politics in the Republican Party. Eric Prince says, you know, we're protecting Americans even as we kill Iraqis.
Right.
You know, talk about, you know, sort of another type of capital that's lost. Let's move on from Eric Prince to the new queen in America. How is that? I made that up on the spot. I know it's hard to believe. It's the narrative. You know, I love covering presidential politics. You know, you and I can be policy wonks, but they, you know, covering presidential politics is like sports for guys who are geeks in high school. And you know, there's always a narrative that evolves and it ebbs and flows and changes. But the narrative this week in the coverage of the presidential campaign is that Hillary Clinton is just about a nanosecond shy of being coronated. You know, that she's opening up, you know, gigantic leads in the national poll, you know, I think 33% points over Barack Obama, and she's actually beginning to establish somewhat of a lead in Iowa and New Hampshire, you know, where they have the first voting, unless, of course, Michigan and Florida have their primaries next week. And, you know, and she's getting endorsement. George McGovern, you know, may not mean much to you, but to liberals, he endorsed her last week, a couple days ago, that is. You know, significant. You know, it looks like she's on the roll, and I don't know if we've talked about this before on the show, but up until recently, I thought that the Iowa caucus might not be that important, that there were at least three candidates that a lot of Democratic voters liked, that being Hillary, Barack Obama, and John Edwards. They all would have enough money and enough free media to do well and continue the fight whoever didn't win in Iowa. But I'm beginning to think now that, you know, Iowa is sort of like the Gettysburg. If neither Barack Obama can stop John or John Edwards can stop Hillary Clinton in Iowa, it may be so long, sister. You know, she's it.
Well, look.
Is the conventional wisdom enveloping me, and you know, like a giant amoeba? And
I mean, just as they say about stereotypes and cliches, there's usually a nugget of truth in them somewhere. You know, look, for every time that there's been some dramatic upset where the mighty, impregnable Lyndon Johnson was, you know, upset by Eugene McCarthy in 1968, there's the other examples where so-and-so just rolled onto victory in the nomination process, really without that much of a fight. Walter Mondale and Gary Hart. I mean, certainly Gary Hart was Obama-like in his... new ideas, fresh face, all that stuff.
Good hair.
Good
looking.
And many ways, probably you could argue, would have been a stronger candidate in the general election back in 1984.
He would have been a great candidate back then. And he would have been a great candidate, I think, in 88 had he not had a little monkey problem.
But the point is, it just looking back at it, though, Mondale was always going to get the nomination. He always had the Democratic establishment in his pocket. Mm-hmm. He always had the reserves. He could afford to lose New Hampshire, as I recall, in 84, that Mondale, that is, and come back to win. You know, I mean, I'm not an expert on Democratic primary politics, and I certainly agree that if Obama can pull off some upset in Iowa, or Edwards, for that matter. But what's worth remembering, though, is that Iowa is much more of an organization, so you can imagine winning New Hampshire just because you get a last-minute surge of people who just show up at the polls and vote for you.
Right.
But Iowa takes, you know, the cliche that takes 3 hours of your evening to do. It's much more of an organizational state. If you don't have people who are really committed to you in advance showing up in big numbers, and remember, when you do show up, you sit in your own little place and so on and so on, so it's not like you have the chance to kind of surprise people in a secret ballot. I mean, you'd have to move across the high school gymnasium from, you know, one camp to another camp in order to be part of it. It's much harder to pull off a shocking upset that nobody sees coming out of nowhere. Iowa than in New Hampshire. And if, as you're saying, David, Iowa is it for the Democrats, not New Hampshire. If Hillary wins big in Iowa, then that's that, because it finishes off Edwards. And Mrs. Obama, of course, has said that I don't have the quote in front of me, but she's pretty much said that if Barack doesn't win Iowa, he's over. Mm-hmm. Then we could be sitting in a situation where the party's front runner just cruises to the nomination, as did, for example, George W. Bush in 2000, or for that matter, Al Gore in 2000, who really never had a lot of excitement and a lot of tension, but in the end, it wasn't much of a race between Bradley and Gore.
Yeah, it was basically New Hampshire, and Gore put Bradley down in New Hampshire, and that was it.
Right.
That seems to be the case. I mean, I think it's possible, looking at things now, Hillary could lose Iowa and still go on to the nomination. I'm not sure you could say that about Barack Obama, and certainly not about John Edwards. Barack Obama does have, you know, a gigantic, well-organized campaign on the ground in Iowa. I mean, he has paid a lot of attention to that. And in fact, there was a chart either in the Times or the Post the last couple of days that I believe showed that he even had more field offices right now than Hillary Clinton. Although Hillary Clinton does have some very veteran organizers like Teresa Velmain, who knows Iowa like the back of her hand. And so I think at the end of the day, the organizing advantage probably will go to Hillary Clinton. So, Obama seems to have taken the lesson that it is Iowa. It's going to be all about Iowa, and he has to sort of, you know, make a stand there, and that is going to be hard because you can't make, because as you say, I don't think you can make it, you know, at the end of the day by making a brilliant speech or by doing well in a debate. It is about convincing the bodies who go to the gymnasiums and so on. But let's see, a candidate who we're not talking about because he's not a candidate is Al Gore. Is Al Gore going to get some good news this week?
Listen, I think that the Nobel, if you're talking about the Nobel Prizes, which I think you are.
Yes, I am. You are correct, sir.
I mean, they are extremely political in who they give their prizes to.
They say that about the Academy
Awards.
You're right.
And guess who won that one? I mean, I think that the Nobel Committee has said explicitly that the reason they gave Jimmy Carter the Nobel Peace Prize was because they thought he was a good critic of Bush.
Right.
The reason they gave Mohammed El-Baradei and the IAEA the Nobel Prize was because they thought he was a good critic of Bush.
And because he got things right, which got him wrong.
Fair enough. But the point is, I think that, but then in that case, the Nobel Committee will say, look, let's continue our streak here. If you and I are a little bit nervous about, simply transferring the conventional wisdom from politics into the heads of Blogging Heads viewers on elections, and we know elections pretty well just from having covered them for all these decades and participated in them in various fashions and so on, our working knowledge of the Nobel Prize Committee is probably, at least in my case, pretty thin. But the precedent of why would you waste...
I've been eating lots of herring lately and making plenty of phone calls. But let's not handicap whether he will or won't get it. But what do you think the impact will be if he does?
Well, I think this will lead... I mean, obviously... Look, it's 86 degrees in Chicago, and people in the marathon are, dying tragically, and there's somebody died here in Washington as well, and a 10K run and so on. So, I mean, it's very hard to argue that the climate isn't changing in some pretty profound way. It's a little harder to know exactly why it's changing, but nonetheless, I mean, we just got through sort of agreeing that the Iraq War is going to go on for for a good long time, or a bad long time. I puzzle, and maybe you can explain this to me, David, how the world system, which includes the Chinese sending us lead toys and the Russians dreaming of recreating the Soviet Empire, and Al-Qaeda in the Middle East doing everything they're doing, I don't understand where all this sort of goodwill and comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, is going to come from to make a very ambitious, unprecedentedly ambitious, a CO2 control regime. And it's easy for me to see California simply saying, look, no more cars.
Right.
It's easy for me to see Germany and France and England passing, and Massachusetts passing some radical anti-CO2 emissions control regime, and Al Gore saying that's exactly what we needed, and my Nobel Prize is one more bona fide on the cause of Kyoto and global warming. What I can't see, and I literally, it's obviously be a huge issue for the rest of my life in the 21st century, is how you're going to make this work with China and India and Russia and, you know...
No one said it was going to be easy. No, I take all your points, and I gosh, I hate this show. I don't disagree with you. But it seems to me, you know, either you go down trying or you just go down without trying. And the science... You know, listen, it could be, once upon a time, yes, everyone thought the world was flat and it turned out that was wrong. The scientific consensus now is overwhelming that this is real, it's happening because we have negative impacts, it's human induced. And it seems to me, you know, like you go with what a doctor tells you, or you bet the odds if you're a smart bettor when you go to Las Vegas. You got to take this into account and start trying to deal with it. I mean, the scary part of the science is that science which posits that there are tipping points, or I should say points of no return. If the underwater, you know, chain, you know, within the Atlantic that brings reasonable, you know, seasonable and mild temperatures to northern Europe breaks down, you can't jumpstart that again by calling AAA. You know, it just boom, you know, there goes, you know, the whole good part of the globe.
Right, but the point is, you and I could promise to ride nothing but bicycles for the rest of our life.
Well, I understand.
And if China continues to build 600 more coal-fired plants,
right.
I think we could be having lost our cars, and by the way, our industry,
right.
And only discover the Chinese are still putting out as much CO2 as we ever were, and they now have the factories to build tanks and submarines.
Right now, though, that's not what it's happening. Right now, we're 3% of the population producing 25% of the gases. So it seems to me there's at least a moral obligation to do something. Now, listen, I don't, you know, I can't promise success, victory, triumph over the forces of global warming or the forces of Chinese ruthless capitalism. I know that. But, you know, it seems to me that you're still obligated to give it a shot. And hopefully, you know, maybe by going first and trying, you will create some of the leapfrog technologies that maybe will be easier for China or India. Maybe they can, go past a few of the steps we went through in our industrial consumer revolution, and maybe not. But, I mean, but certainly doing nothing, you know, seems to, you know, to guarantee failure. You know, trying something may not guarantee success if China, India, and other nations, you know, Indonesia even maybe at some point in time, surpass us as emission producers. And just, you know, Bush the other week coming out saying, I care, there's a problem, I want to do something, and not proposing anything new, certainly is not the way to go. And I believe, as terrible as the Iraq War may be, 50 years from now, there's as good a chance that historians will look back and see that the real failure of his administration was not Iraq, but doing nothing about global warming, at least trying to take the lead. And listen, convincing Russia, China, all those points you make are correct, but short of your overall solution to everything, which is leave the planet, which we're going to get to in a moment. I see no choice. But you wanted to talk about leaving the planet.
I would say that, look, I certainly, if Al Gore wins the Nobel Peace Prize and is smart about it, he's going to say that the solution is going to be a radical rethinking of technology such that we move toward clean technologies, whatever those are, and the obvious suspects are nuclear, solar, hydrogen, you know, you name it, and that if it will not be a dramatic downshifting in our lifestyle or standard of living, but actually an upshifting thanks to new technology. The fear that a lot of Americans have is that the real environmental agenda is Luddite and anti-growth and anti-bourgeois. Now, if Al Gore can convince the American people that that's not the case, then in fact the environmental movement, aside from a few random outriders, but the real environmental movement is pro-American and pro-middle class and pro-economic growth, they're just going to do it in a different way, then he really will have earned not only his Nobel Prize, but the right to be president of the planet someday.
he could win that election, certainly if he ran against Bush. Listen, you know, there is something, I don't know if Shakespearean is the right word here, but to lose, if losing is the right word, to Bush in 2000, then coming back to become, in essence, the president of the planet with this Nobel Peace Prize would be quite amazing. Last, you know, quick question on this, and that is, I think the answer is no. Do you think there's any chance that should he win, that he'll try to pivot into the presidential election?
No, I actually think that we both have sort of been touching on it, and that is that there really does sort of exist now a sort of an office, if you will, a sort of a psychic, virtual political office that is greater than the U.S. presidency.
Yep.
And that is, I mean, and that Bill Clinton and Bill Gates and sort of, Bono.
Yeah, he's going to be a Bono.
Kind of
with the edge as vice president.
kind of inhabit that sort of larger place in our, you know, the late Princess Diana was kind of an early holder of that post.
And you know what? I think it's fun.
Well,
I mean, how much more fun could Bill Clinton say? And don't give me the obvious could have. Don't give me the obvious answer. Than sort of trotting around like this without the headache of balancing budgets, dealing with Republicans. You know, Bill Gates. You know, basically, you know, beat, you know, a lot of better, you know, products into the ground on his way to earning billions, and now he's saving, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives in Africa by giving out malaria nets. I mean, Jimmy Carter is certainly having more fun now than he ever did in the White House. And I think Al Gore, I mean, I interviewed him when the movie came out. It sounded like he was literally having a blast, off to con, but also off to talk to the Chinese government about what to do and trying to convince them. I mean, it's not all glamour, it's work, but God, it seems fun, rewarding, without any of the headaches of, you know, especially cleaning up the mess in Iraq.
Exactly. I think that is going to, I mean, the same way that it's probably more fun to be the president of the European Union or the European Commission or whatever the exact title is.
Yeah.
Than the head of state of any one of those little those respective 26 countries there. So no, I think the long answer here is that I think Al Gore will. I mean, who knows? But I think he will certainly for 2008. I mean, I think look, if he's looking at the same newspaper articles and about Hillary's inevitability as we are, I think that President Hillary Clinton will find herself if she wins stuck.
Al Gore reminds me of the, you know, geek in high school who, you know, was, you know, front of the class all the time, and then he loses an election, to use a word that some people might quibble with, to the high school jock, but then later on in life, he's king of the world, he's doing just fine, while that jock has gone down in flames.
Well, it's sort of the story of the U.S. economy in the knowledge age, and that is that the good-looking jock doesn't do as well as the computer nerd. I mean, that's sort of what happened in the last...
I'm all for nerds doing well, as I suspect you might be. But going back to my previous point that for so many of the problems that plague us, Jim Pinkerton has the great answer. Get off the planet. You are a space maven. You love thinking about space. You advocate space exploration and research on this. And I'm with you, you know, to a certain extent on some of this. But you're kind of sad because this week, an anniversary passed of a glorious moment for the fatherland, Russia, Mother Russia, and
I think they call it the motherland.
Right.
October 4th.
What happened? And what did not get the attention?
October 4th is the 50th anniversary of Sputnik, which was a major. Not that many Americans can remember that anymore, and frankly, I can't either. But I read about it a lot, and it was a seismic event in American politics, where the U.S. was seen as having been let the Soviets with all their high tech get ahead of us. Now,
well, for younger viewers out there, I know our demographics skew to the 18 to 24 range, which is why this buds for you. Just give us the basics of Sputnik.
Well, I mean, the Soviet Union put a unmanned satellite into space on October 4th.
But it was really something that was like the size of a
basketball.
Fruit can,
right.
A basketball, when it just all it did was make a beep.
Right. One of the scientists who worked on that spot, who's now 95 years old, mm-hmm. Is giving interviews for the first time, saying, "Look, you have no idea how thrown together it was, and how the Kremlin really didn't think it even get off the launching pad, let alone, you know, become the big event that it was. And actually, Walter McDougall, who's a distinguished professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, has done research on this, gone back then, and has figured out, look, the Americans actually could have put something in space first, before Sputnik, but chose not to because they wanted the Soviets to go first as a way of establishing the principle of overflight, and that is that, you know, because legally speaking, you know, your air rights, if you will, over your country go all the way up into infinity, and the notion of having a satellite overhead, you know, would have violated that. And the Americans figured that the Soviets did it first and flew over and therefore, in a sense, violated American airspace.
Right.
Then the Russians couldn't complain if we did it to them. And of course, to tie together these various themes of getting off the planet, but also even before then, the notion of government-directed technological development.
Mm-hmm.
The President Eisenhower not only created the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in 1958, but also, you know, signed the National Defense Education Act, which was the big signature effort.
That was the big response to Sputnik.
Exactly.
You know, it was like,
yeah.
Oh my God, the Russians are ahead of us in technology. We better cram some science and math into our kids' heads.
Exactly, and they did. It wasn't perfect, but it was better than nothing. And it was the realization was we couldn't just settle for hiring a few scientists to build rockets. We needed a whole generation of physicists and mathematicians and so on.
Otherwise, where would Tang come from?
Well, where would the internet come from? I mean, when you go down the list. In other words,
there
is. There's no question that this is sort of a point that libertarians have to get their heads around, and that is the politicians can sit in marble palaces in the Capitol and simply snap their fingers and summon into being scientific research. It does happen sometimes, and
technological advancement. The Transcontinental Railroad.
Yep.
That was a federal initiative too, as was the internet, as you mentioned. You know, I've been saying for years. Imagine if the feds took the money that we poured into Iraq, $1 trillion or so, and just at an obvious loss, said, okay, we're going to put a solar panel on every residential home. You know, we will give everybody a $10,000 tax cut the first 5 million people who do this, and go ahead, and you know that would create a market. I mean,
Just Wi-Fi. What if we just simply declared Wi-Fi for the country?
That's exactly.
I agree. I think this is a major failing of the politics of both the left, which is sort of preoccupied with welfare and income transfers, and the right, which is sort of opposed to everything. They both have missed the element of science and technology and where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And if people come up with it on their own, fine. But if they need a little boost to do so, that's fine too. And that takes back to the space program, which what is so striking to me, as I wrote a column on this last week, is to think back and remember that in the popular culture of the 50s and 60s, the popular and political culture of the 50s and 60s, it was just accepted that not only would we get to the moon by 1969, by the end of the decade, as President Kennedy promised, but that in the decades to follow, the space program would continue and regularize and routinize to the point where, if you remember the movie 2001,
sure, Pan Am,
and of all places, the year 2001,
yeah,
we have a regular Pan Am shuttle running between the Earth and the Moon. And
were those cool stewardesses who could go around like this. But also, we were promised flying cars as well.
Well,
and jet boosters on, to go instead of Segways. We were promised a lot of things, Jim, and they haven't delivered.
I think the trial lawyers had a fair amount to do with a lot of that being spiked. But also, there's just no question
that liability waivers.
Well, that's right. That's what it takes. That's what it took to get the railroads built. Was they simply
of course condemning people's property and giving them to the big companies.
Well, that's what you do. Yeah, that's right. Look, in other words, you go back to the history of railroads, history of turnpikes, the history of canals.
Moses in New York City, the power broker.
Right.
All these things,
plenty of to coin a phrase, eggs got broken to make those omelets.
I think Joe Stalin said that. Yes. We'll put you right in this Stalin camp when it comes to making.
For example, one of the issues of railroads was sparks, and this, we're talking the early 19th century now, or the early mid 19th century. Yeah. Sparks flying off of railroads and setting farmers' fields on fire, and you know the farmers would sue and clobber the railroads, and then they had to sort of basically come up with rules that would insulate railroads from these kinds of lawsuits because it was just understood it was more important.
Of course, the company's always had the options, too, of sending in the Pinkertons. Any connection there, Jim?
There is no connection.
Too bad.
My great-grandfather was still in Northern Ireland when Alan Pinkerton was nearly losing the Civil War for the Union.
Now, you wanted to ask me about some changes.
Well, yes, David. What's new with you?
What's new with me is after 20 years of being Washington editor of The Nation magazine, I am switching perches in a couple weeks at the end of the month, and I'll become the head, the D.C. bureau chief for Mother Jones magazine. And what was enticing to me is that Mother Jones has created a bureau of 6 reporters, writers, 7 plus me, here in Washington, which is going in the opposite direction of what's happening with a lot of media consolidation. Time magazine, I'm told, has a bureau with about 6 people in it. So I will have, 6 reporters to deploy around Washington to produce news for the magazine, but more, perhaps even more so, for the MotherJones.com website, which will be expanding and really becoming, as equally important as the magazine, hopefully in the months ahead.
Now, what I find interesting about Mother Jones, and because I know this structure has existed for a while, is it's a foundation, right?
Yes, the magazine is owned, operated, whatever, by a foundation.
Right. In other words, what's going on, I think, in terms of the changes in the media, are the ability to make a profit running a mainstream media entity is, shall we say, shrinking, if not evaporating.
The other day, when I was thinking about making this change, and it was kind of hard to do this. I've been at The Nation for 20 years. I've had a good run. It's very comfortable, and at my advanced age, why make life more difficult? But I like the challenge, and there was also a little more money involved. But when I was thinking this, I said, I'm going from one media operation that may break even, but certainly historically has lost money, to another one that doesn't support itself, but the revenues are covered by contributions. And then I said, wait a second, schmuck. There's what news organization this day actually supports itself, in the free market. The Washington Post would be nowhere without Stanley Kaplan, the education crib service that they own that makes a lot of money. Most of the network news divisions lose money and are subsidized by the reality shows and the entertainment shows. The New York Times is propped up a bit by real estate holdings. A lot of even the giants, MSNBC, I'm not calling them a giant, but MSNBC, I don't know if CNN is making money anymore, maybe Fox is, but if you look at publications of the right and the left, the National Review, the Weekly Standard, American Prospect, have all long been supported outside of the market, not by market forces. So it seems now that anybody who's involved in producing news or commentary has to do so somewhat based on either the kindness of strangers or fellow travelers or the profits of a sister corporation.
Right. I think that's exact, and I think the sister corporation thing will, somebody will eventually, if what you're saying about the Washington Post is true, and I'm not disputing you, I'm just saying I hadn't really thought about that, that even the Post, which is a shadow of what it used to be physically in terms of the weight it had and the number of articles and how thick it is and so on, if that's being propped up by Stanley Kaplan, then some Weisenheimer on Wall Street is going to figure out, look, the Stanley Kaplan by itself would be worth a lot of money, and who needs a stupid Washington Post anymore? That would be the kind of hard-nosed thinking, which has happened to the Tribune Company, for example.
Well, that will happen because the Post, is a public company.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It has, the family, the Grahams have a lot of control over it. But you've seen this happen, yes, with the Knight Ritter papers too. And you saw it happen, of course, with the Wall Street Journal.
Right. And so in the same way, however, that there's always a room for egomaniacal, billionaires and do-gooders and philanthropists and civic pillar types.
Yeah.
In the same way they used to buy sports teams or would endow museums and so on, I think that what we're seeing now is that much of the media that we think of is going to be transformed into some sort of C3 nonprofit foundational format because there's just no other way. And they won't even pretend to try and make money. They'll simply put it all online, give it away for free, and hope that they're going to get compensated in terms of civic approbation as opposed to profitability. And I think this is a major trend in our time, and I think that most media outlets, and again, they're expanding. I mean, what's so striking is that if Mother Jones has the same number of reporters in Washington as Time Magazine, then it just shows that there's always going to be a willingness among sort of, you know, visionary philanthropist types to say, listen, I believe in these causes or these ideas or these principles or whatever, and I'm going to invest heavily in it. And the same way that people used to endow universities and hospitals and,
Remember, you know, the stories of Paley and CBS News. They used to consider it a public obligation, a public service, to do documentaries in prime time, knowing that they don't bring in as much money or any money as did the regular entertainment shows. But there was an obligation to do that, and of course it's gone now because the bean counters, you know, won't let something like that happen.
And the FCC has changed too. I mean, part of it was also the rules changed. I mean, the rules of the FCC was much more conscious of people's licenses and why they could keep them. So I think that would be part of it as well, because eventually the constituencies for civic, philanthropic, whatever somebody will come up with a term for this, media, will then go to the government and say, look, we want better tax treatment, you know, whatever it might be.
You know, the sad thing is, too, that in terms of, you know, producing some news, as we've seen from blogging heads, TV perhaps, you know, has gotten cheaper. You know, putting up a website, you know, what Matt Drudge did, which isn't quite news, was really pretty easy to mount. And now anybody can run around with a video camera, and if they get something newsworthy, they can post it on YouTube, whatever, the Macaca video with George Allen, and you can really compete. But doing things like covering the war in Iraq is incredibly difficult, incredibly expensive, and if the network and you know the people who used to do this a lot, well, the big newspapers and the network news shows are all cutting back, and you know, during Vietnam we had literally hundreds and hundreds of reporters out there from all different type of outlets, large and small, you know, bringing back news. This gets actually, you know, to the earlier point we were talking about at the beginning of the show about, you know, reporting on the reality of the ground. But now in terms of what's happening in Iraq, because it's so much more difficult, because journalists are targeted, that raises the cost. You need security. It also makes it, you know, harder for journalists to do the job. It takes a hell of a lot of guts to do this, and networks are under the gun ever and ever about maximizing profits. They don't want to spend a lot of money. They don't want to pay a lot of people to do this. So it does mean that when it comes to certain issues, certain subject areas, like what's happening in Iraq outside the Green Zone, we're not going to get that information.
I agree with that, which makes me, you know, I wonder, for example, 2 points. One, do you think, and I mean this as an open-ended question, that there are satellite photographs of what happened in Baghdad a few weeks ago with the Blackwater thing? I mean, literally. I'm not trying. I'm just wondering whether somebody in the government, you know, has pictures of Blackwater interacting with civilians, you know, in gunfire. And also, if that's just a question anybody has an answer to, I'd be curious what it might be. The second point is, I will predict, David, and this is not based on any inside conversation between that you and I have had off camera, and that is that Mother Jones or some other you know, ambitious. You can't even call it a magazine anymore, can you? Just call it a portal or outfit or something, you know, whatever media thing. We'll figure out some new way to get coverage and footage and from Iraq. Some collaboration with some, you know, Arab media that can, you know, a little more comfortable moving around the country. You know, people with their cell phones. I mean, something. Because I think because anybody who takes the news seriously and has a lot invested in terms of the story, and you and have done as much reporting as anybody on Iraq, at least anybody in Washington, and I'm sure you feel a duty to help your viewers and readers and clickers and so on learn more about it. I'll just be interested in seeing what new formations come, because the same technology that lets blogging heads do this on a shoestring, and I do mean a shoestring.
A shoestring on a good day. Usually it's just a pair of loafers.
People can see from, you know, my sweaty, shiny forehead and these little cameras and so on. We're not spending a lot of money here. Of course, we are doing our best to get the truth out, and if we were in Iraq, it would be that much more interesting. And, you know, between little cameras and satellites, actually, the cost of actually moving images from here to Iraq or and vice versa isn't really that great. It's expensive, obviously, in security and travel, but the actual technology is kind of cheap.
Yeah. The technology's gotten easier, and the mobility has gotten tougher.
Which does remind me of one last point I'll make, and that is about the changes in the media, and that is I wrote a column in which I said that the major new sort of sheriffs on the block, as it were, are all these sort of, and they're not profit-making organizations at all. They're all C3s, whether it's Media Research Center or Media Matters or the Annenberg Center or 100 others sort of doing it to one degree or another.
Factcheck.org.
Exactly. There is a new phenomenon because people are conscious as the media shrink and as the media, for lack of a better word, deprofessionalize in terms of, certified capital J journalists being replaced by bloggers in pajamas and so on and so on. There is a geistial sense that somebody's got to be sort of fact-checking and policing things and so on. And there's been a whole rise of all this sort of alternative, media, which obviously can have a real, as Don Imus or Dan Rather can attest, they can have a colossal effect on the process by the simple expedient of recording and transcribing everything that is said by all the various media players, however much they proliferate.
Well, that makes me think about me. one thing that I was thinking about in terms of this new job was, and again, this is my seat of the pants, which you can't see, hunch here, which is that I'm all for bloggers who rant, rave, and do good analysis, good commentary, point out what's gone wrong with traditional media or alternative media. There's a role for that. But I think there's also something of a quasi-neo backlash to the blogosphere. And it's my belief that there are people out there who have seen the rise of blogitary, if I can coin a word, a term.
Blogitary. That's not a disease, is it?
Maybe it is. Maybe it is. But the idea of using the advantages that internet technology gives you as a journalist to produce news and fact-driven reporting, a fact-driven analysis that can compete to a limited degree with some existing mainstream news organizations has not really been maximized. People have, the internet hasn't produced new journalists. It's produced new bloggers.
Well, I'll give you one area where it has produced new journalists, and I'm not trying to be funny.
Okay.
Hollywood. TMZ and SmokingGun.com do, admittedly, on subjects that may be beneath, the respectable opinion.
I care about Britney's weight as much as
anybody.
Well,
the point is, but Smoking Gun has all these court documents.
I know. Yep.
And TMZ has court documents. In other words, at a moment when Vanity Fair and People Magazine and most of the TV entertainment shows do nothing but certified interviews with people saying exactly what they want to say, with agents and lawyers supervising the script and the taping process, these new sort of guerrilla outfits, whatever you want to call them, although they're certainly corporate, are doing exactly what you would want to do if you were in Washington.
You're exactly right, and that's what I hope we can do in Washington. And I hope we can add productively to the din of information coming out of Washington, and have it be fact-driven news and views and analysis and commentary and breaking stories that will have, as they like to say in the business, value added.
Well, when I read about these torture memos and I see all these people on TV talking about things where they can't, a basic question like, is there a difference between being briefed on and actually seeing the memo? The Nancy Pelosi and all these Democrats are saying, look, we didn't really know the details of this, and then the Bush administration said, well, yes, you did.
You didn't.
And back and forth and back and forth, and I'm not here to point fingers either way, although I have a general bias against torture. You find yourself struggling. Somebody, please tell me one thing that we know for sure is true as to what Al Gonzalez may or may not have told Harry Reid.
Well, come to MotherJones.com in a couple of weeks. I won't be starting to the end of the month, and I will do what I can to make Jim Pinkerton.
Well, you should put a feature up there. I'm dead serious. Mm-hmm. Of here's the reader question of the day.
Yep.
And we got seven people here, and one of the seven of us is going to answer this question. You know, and it may be sort of by Washington standards, sort of a naive question or simple-minded question, or maybe a wise fool question.
Why are we in Iraq? Yes.
But why are we in Iraq, or what actually is going on? Because I've lived in this town since 1980 for 27 years, and I don't know. As I read through the major media articles on torture and back and forth, who was told what, and I literally don't know. I'd love to see a smokinggun.com apply to Washington as opposed to Hollywood.
You are our target audience. You are our focus group. My mission is clear. I accept your challenge. I respond to your inspiration. I will try to do good by you.
My eyeballs are up for grabs on this.
Okay, well, to be continued. Jim, as always, it's a pleasure. I'll see you soon on Blog.
See you from your new post.
Bye.
Bye-bye.